This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
So even for me as a happy person, it added so much of happiness and positivity. So it was hands down the single most meaningful thing I've ever done in my whole life, that I was literally the next day, I was like, okay, I can totally see if it's doing this amount of positivity to me as a healthy, happy person, I can totally see how this might be able to cure and help people with mental health issues.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. Thank you for tuning in. I am Danny Fortson, the West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times and your host. We have a great podcast for you this week, and it is all about psychedelics. On the program to talk about it is Christian Angermeyer. He is the founder of Atai Life Sciences, which recently went public on the NASDAQ at around $3 billion. And Atai is just totally unique. It is the world's largest, and I'm pretty certain the only, psychedelics company. And what it has done over the past few years is really recast magic mushrooms, ketamine, ibogaine, these substances that are either classified as Class A drugs or just illegal drugs, and really reposition them as potentially breakthrough medicines for a whole range of mental health problems, most notably treatment-resistant depression. They are all now in clinical trials of various stages, including at Compass Pathways, which Atai is a big investor in, and Compass, of course, is the London-based developer of psilocybin-based treatments for depression. But Angermeyer has been driving this bus just for a number of years, a pretty lonely pursuit, and how he got there is really interesting. He's a biotech entrepreneur, he's a venture capitalist, and some years back, he took magic mushrooms, had an amazing experience, and then was convinced by a small but growing body of academic work and studies that there's a real business here, there's a real opportunity to turn psychedelics toward our very severe and growing mental health crisis. And so that is what he has done with Atai, and they've made some pretty amazing progress just in a pretty short period of time. And Angermeyer does a bunch of other stuff as well. He's a film producer. He's also the biggest investor in DEAG, which is a big live events and concerts company. And he's got some interesting friends. So alongside him on this whole psychedelics journey were Peter Thiel, you know, the Facebook billionaire, Mike Novogratz, another billionaire big in the crypto world. And it was basically those three who helped really fund Atai, get it off the ground, and really get some momentum, along with a bunch of other people in the industry, behind psychedelics as something other than just, you know, a recreational drug, but actually something that can help people. So I brought him on. We'd actually had him on 2 years ago when Atai was still pretty new. So I brought him on to talk about, you know, the progress, what's happened over the past 2 years, and how things are looking as Atai moves forward now as a public company, and the work they're doing and what the world looks like in terms of mental health and mental health treatment. So I think you'll really enjoy it. It's a fascinating conversation. So without further ado, I give you Christian Angermeyer, the founder of Atai Life Sciences. Enjoy. Thanks for taking the time. So we were just saying before we started recording, it's been many moons since you were first on the pod.
practically 24, more or less exactly. Yes. So thanks for having me again.
Yeah, absolutely. So the world has changed quite a bit. So I saw, obviously, you guys went public on Friday. But I think when you were on back in March 2019, Atai was pretty new. The idea of a psychedelics company was pretty new. So I was wondering if you just talk about, you know, you had to just spend, I don't know how long, talking to investors, people with money, and trying to convince them that this is a thing that is worth investing in. It's a good business, that it's realistic. I wonder if you just talk about like what that experience has been, especially when we go back 2.5 years when you just started this thing and it seemed like a bit more kind of an out there idea.
Totally. It was April, May, but like 2019. And it was indeed like your podcast. And then it was around the Milken conference. So this was sort of the first, and it was definitely the first of our, let's call it, public appearance. I was super excited talking about my own psychedelic experience with you and then later on stage. So what has happened? Meaning we started at Thai 2018 and Compass Pathways, one of our portfolio companies, which we spun out and IPO'd separately. We started actually already 2017, based in London. Yeah. And both are now, so Atai and Compass are listed here in the US on NASDAQ. So yeah, so at the very beginning, it was like, finally, like, really, I had some very early supporters, which are very grateful, notably, mainly Mike Novogratz and Peter Thiel. And even those two, who are known for making sort of wild bets or whatever, were like, you know what, like, we trust you because we do a lot of other stuff together, but it's a bit crazy. So it was very interesting to see the most sort of, how you say, accomplished tech investor friends I have, like, even them, like, okay, we don't know, but let's see. But at least they were in, but it was not actually so. In the early days, it was not easy to raise outside capital. So we were in this lucky position, hindsight, if I look back, that we sort of, I mean, Atai and Compass together, we reinvented the psychedelic business in this century or in this millennia, because obviously there was one in the last century. And the only way why it worked, and I believe very much in this sort of a little bit that it's fate, is because also I was able to put in a lot of money myself on my conviction. So I'm an unusual founder because I'm also an investor. So I put in actually $40 million myself over various rounds. Yeah.
Of your own money.
Of my own money, yeah. So I was really convinced from the beginning, obviously. Yeah, but like, so I think if I hadn't been able to do that, it wouldn't have come together because it was too outlandish at the beginning. And it really just changed in 2020.
So can we just pause for a second? Because for those who didn't hear the first podcast, I mean, you just said you were so convinced that you put $40 million of your own money into this. Why were you so convinced? And I presume it was because you had this experience. So I wonder if you could just talk about that so people understand where you're coming from.
So first of all, meaning as a background, which I think which is also important, is that I sort of run my family office and my own investment business. So, and I'm doing both. So we, as a default position, we're investing in tech and biotech with my family office at Pyron. And then once in a while, and Atai is obviously our lighthouse example for that, we also start in companies ourselves, always then when we have a novel idea like Atai. So, and there is not a company out there we could invest because there is none. So I had my first, really ever first psychedelic experience in 2014, which I always say is notable to know. And this is also one of the reasons why from the beginning, at least in my friend circle, and then this grew, I was always easy to talk about this, that I'm most likely the least, let's call it, druggy person you're going to ever meet. Like, because till 2014, I had not done anything else, not even alcohol, meaning I've never tried alcohol in my whole life, still not. I've never smoked a cigarette, never smoked a joint. And then there was this sequence of things. Again, there is so much things happened, like in the right order that I, meaning again, in general, I believe in fate in life. So, but like, so several things had happened like pre-2014, where I had met a scientist, Rainer Spannagel, who's a very famous neuroscientist. And he was the first one ever to tell me about psychedelics and especially mushrooms.
Yeah.
So he gave me sort of the intellectual backbone. Yeah, and I started reading about it. I was not convinced, though. Meaning, I was like, "Oh my God, it's still like I'm such a coward, actually, and such a so." But then other friends mentioned it suddenly as well. So a lot of people, you know, when it pops up left and right. And then I was on an island in the Caribbean in 2014. So in a country always to mention, but it was really like it's where it's legal. And friends had it, and I was like, okay, you know what? Like I read so much about it, and the science is so convincing because meaning there was all the science in the 60s. It was once a legal medical treatment already. Like we have all the data. So I was like, you know what? Let's do it. And even I was already a happy person. So it was not like I wasn't coming from looking for healing or whatever. So even for me as a happy person, it added so much of happiness and positivity. So it was hands down the single most meaningful thing I've ever done in my whole life. That I was literally the next day, I was like, okay, I can totally see if it's doing this amount of positivity to me as a healthy, happy person, I can totally see how this might be able to cure and help people with mental health issues. And it was sort of the beginning of my thought process.
So were you just on a beautiful beach somewhere and you're like, I'm going to take magic mushrooms, and it was just a fantastic trip, basically?
Yes, exactly. That was the short version of it, yeah. Although I think the set and setting is super important, but
yeah.
So most of the stuff happened in my head. Like, so the beach then vanished and I went into my own wonderland. But like, yes, but it was an amazing set. And especially, I think even more important than the beach, it was with the right people. So my two best friends, Julian and Landon, who had experience with mushrooms, so I felt sort of safe. I had a shaman. And that's, by the way, exactly what we want to recreate now medically. So
there was a shaman there as well.
Well, kind of. Like shaman is like a broad word, but somebody who takes care of you. Like it's
right.
It's not something you should do alone. And that's also what a Thai wants to do. So we want to make it medic. This is super important because people are always asking me, like, do you want to make it like free sellable, like cannabis? Is it the same like cannabis? And it's not. Like, we want to make certain psychedelics available for the medical use, and under the guidance of a psychotherapist or a doctor or a qualified person.
Right. And so fast forward to your past, whatever, however long this roadshow was, what was the reception? Because as you say, you know, a lot's happened in the past 2.5 years. Compass went public, I believe, last September in London, which is obviously a big moment for the kind of, let's call it the industry. I don't know if you can call it that yet. But how was it when you're going around to institutions and pension funds and Wall Street and just being like, okay, this is what we're doing. We're creating this company around all these different psilocybin and or ketamine-based therapies.
So you mean how the roadshow was now for the IPO?
Yes.
It was interestingly, again, it completely switched from zero to hero or from crazy to accepted. Like it was a very almost normal roadshow. Like we had a broad reception from all types of investors, from mutual funds, as you say, to pension funds, to hedge funds, to specialized biotech funds, meaning it was very... And I mean, two things I think happened. One is I really credit a lot, so a big shout out to Michael Pollan. Yeah, and there were others, but Michael Pollan, I think with his book, How to Change Your Mind, literally changed the mind of people a lot about psychedelics. And then also even leave psychedelics aside for a second, I think the whole problem, so mental health issues as the most likely biggest problem of healthcare at the moment, like over the last 12 months, really got into the focus of both of the society, of investors, of politicians. Yeah. And that together, sort of the awareness for the problem and just the number, because I always think it's so striking because I didn't know it before I was thinking about that thing in 2014 or before I started. It's like there's 1 billion people suffering from one or more mental health issues, and that's just the official number. So the unofficial one is most likely way higher because it's a stigmatized disease still, so people are not easy coming forward with it. Yeah, and that's, I think, also one of the reasons why the number is growing, because more and more people sort of come forward. So yeah, so I think it's that. It's sort of the awareness for the problem combined with sort of a more, I don't want to say pragmatic, but like a more realistic view on psychedelics, because some of them had been already medications in the last century. So it's practically, this is what it was always for me. Like, and it just took a while till sort of investors and society caught up. It's like, if you have a huge problem and you have a solution which worked in the last century, I'm pretty confident it's going to work in this century as well. Yeah. So, and that sort of has in the meantime become like usual wisdom.
And so we had George from Compass on the pod probably 6 months ago or longer. And the way that psilocybin therapy has been described to me, especially for people with, I think it's treatment resistant depression, is that it's quite good. It kind of, if you think of your depression as like you're like a broken record stuck in a groove, and this knocks you out of that groove. So there's Compass as part of a tie, and then you've got a few other psilocybin-based treatments, but then you also have some other ones with ketamine and the other one you said, which I can't remember.
Ibogaine.
Is that the same kind of mechanism, or is it different?
In detail, it's different. It's sort of, I would go one step back. So all psilocybin stuff is in Compass. Yeah. So yeah. Practically on the Atai platform, we still own 20% of Compass, which is sort of these psilocybin company. And then we have other compounds directly on Atai level where we own the majority up to 100%. Like an ibogaine is one of them. Then a DMT, which people know often of from the ritualistic brew ayahuasca, which is the main ingredient or the active ingredient is DMT. Then a new version of ketamine, R-ketamine, salvia, and so on. And by the way, that's the interesting, I would say that way, like mental health, meaning our brain is really like a very beautiful and complex organ. And this is why there is not one reason for a mental health issues. There is sort of various ones. And interestingly, psychedelic seem to, because I always have to add like what Compass and Atai are up to is like proving it once and for all. And we're sort of in the process. So everything I have to say sort of as an assumption. Yeah. But they seem to address, interestingly, various form of reasons. Like if you are in this broken record problem, yeah, they kick you out of it. Like it's like, I call it like a positive trauma or like a super positive thing. But for example, for other people, the reason for mental health issues can be like a trauma. And then it's really going right to that and let's call it dissolving it or let you work through the trauma, but by that solving it. Yeah. Mm. A lot of people actually feel the reason is, and there's a great book also, which is called, I'm blanking now, but it's about disconnection. Like a lot of people sort of, you can trace back the mental health issues of, it's called Lost Connections, about not feeling connected to humanity, to other people, to nature. So in that case, psychedelics are bringing back that connection. Yeah. So there's many root cases. And the interesting thing is they seem to really go sort of where you need it. And then depending what the issue is, some seem to be better for the one thing, some for the other. For example, ibogaine, let's go to the most sort of extreme, but most interesting one from my point of view, because ibogaine seems to have the potential to completely cure any addiction up to opioid addiction, which is obviously a huge problem, especially in the US. And so there is anecdotal evidence.
So you're talking about alcohol, for example.
Yeah, but I always want to say alcohol is almost easy. Like the strongest addiction we know is heroin and opioids. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it dissolves kind of any form of addiction, but even actually opioid and heroin addiction. Alcohol addiction, there are also some interesting studies already with psilocybin, whatever. So it seems to be that sort of like for alcohol, cigarette addiction, that stuff, you can work with psilocybin. DMT, for example, is also very anti-addictive or seems to be anti-addiction solving. But like sort of for like heroin and opioid, ibogaine seems to be the best one.
So potentially, so just so I understand, because it was a bit unclear, ibogaine can potentially, or shown potential,
to dissolve addiction. Like you,
for opioid addicts, for heroin addicts.
Yes. Yeah. So you do a trip, and there are ibogaine clinics in Mexico where people do that. This is why we have that, what we call anecdotal evidence.
Oh, really?
And it seems to be that one trip has the potential to completely dissolve the addiction.
Wow.
which is big, which is huge. I mean, especially when you look at how addiction and especially opioid addiction is ripping apart America.
And ibuprofen, what is that from? What's the origin?
It's originally, we synthesize it, but it's originally from a plant or like a tree in West Africa, in Gabon, actually. So, and it's just there. It's native to that area. And the native people there use it as a rite of passage. And if you want the psychological explanation, again, always with the disclaimer, we are about to prove it medically. So the people who took ibogaine anecdotally and got healed, they report that it's a little bit like purgatory. So you practically revisit in a trip which can last up to 48 hours. This is why, meaning that's the most obvious one where it becomes clear that you need to do it under medical guidance, yeah? But that you revisit all sort of kind of the bad decisions you made.
Oh, God.
Which led up to your addiction. But that shows like how you need to break the cycle. So I think a lot of stuff is like, if people are treated with mental health issues in general, it's just on the surface. And this is why it never works, because most of the mental health problems, they are so deeply ingrained in our brain. And at ibogaine, you really literally revisit your journey, which led you to the addiction. But by doing that, it sort of breaks the pattern.
Wow. And how did you guys come across that? Is there academic research on this? Or, I mean, because it sounds like there's some clinics in Mexico, but I mean, until I was reading your slide deck, I had never even heard of it before.
So what is important, because I really want to give all of them massive credit, because I always say like, we at Atai did not invent psychedelics, obviously. Yeah. We did, we reinvented, as you call it, the psychedelic industry, the psychedelic business, or the medical side of it in this millennia. But first of all a lot of these substances are used by humans since thousands of years. There are even some researchers who think that they're used since 200,000 of years. There is this one interesting theory, like the stoned ape theory, that they could even have sparked humanity and sort of the step from the apes. Well, because it's always the question, what makes us human?
So the stoned ape theory, which I have not heard before.
Oh my God, it's my favorite theory. Because I believe in it.
That's an amazing, it sounds like an amazing theory. So the idea is that maybe an ape eats some of this tree in Gabon or whatever, and then kind of has this experience and is like, maybe I should do more with my opposable thumbs and start walking on just on my hind legs.
Well, that is maybe the simplified version of it. Yeah. Yes. Interestingly, like what happens after psychedelic trips is what we call neuroplasticity. Yeah. So your brain, literally, super simplified said, starts growing and developing new neurons and so whatever. So, which is, by the way, also one effect. So you have this immense positive experience during the trip, but then the neuroplasticity is one of the things which helps you integrating that into your sort of life, because it doesn't end with the trip, but the post-integration work is extremely important. This is why also, again, it's so important to do it with a therapist, not just while you're doing it, but he or she is going to help you with that integration work. But like, so you have this neuroplasticity, so there is sort of an element of brain growth to it. And then you have this sort of spiritual experience. And if you think about what makes us human, so I had a discussion with one of the scientists who's sort of doing research, like what and if psychedelics like were done by our ancestors like hundreds of thousands of years ago. So one of the things which makes us human is the sort of spiritual part of us. Yeah. So, which, by the way, it can be proven that humans are the only, I was super amazed about that, like humans are the only animal who has, every single human worldwide has a ritualized way, and we always had that, so you can trace that back a long time, to honor the dead. And no animal is doing that. Sometimes an elephant might put a little bit of grass on their body, but they don't do it structurally all around the world. All elephants are doing something.
Right.
Yeah. So, but you just honor the dead if you have sort of an idea that there is more to life than just a dead body. Yeah, so and maybe they will start putting psychedelics, meaning it's a theory which is hard to prove, but they did find psychedelic plants in really, really old graves and stuff like that. So so there are indications. And what I would always recommend is, and if you haven't had him on the podcast, it's a must. It's like Brian Murarescu, a friend of mine. He wrote an amazing book called The Immortality Key, where he traced back most big religions, including Christianity, to the use of psychedelics. So not as a theory, but like as partly proven, because right. they found substances in ancient like ceremonial cups and graves and whatever.
So can I just, when you were meeting with like, I don't know, pick your big institution, BlackRock or, you know, Firefighters Fund or whatever, did the stoned ape theory come up?
Sometimes. I'm very forward with that. So I know that some said it was a different kind of roadshow partly, but like, yeah, it does. Like, I like it. Meaning, I like to bring it up. Yeah.
That's funny. I mean, the other thing, obviously, the perhaps the biggest thing is regulatory aspect of this, you know, because I think, to your point, there was like this whole, there's been this kind of reversal, or at least in this awakening of the potential of these drugs for therapeutic purposes. And you guys are in the midst of doing these trials at Compass and elsewhere to prove that out. But these are class A drugs. They're illegal.
Well, they are illegal for consumption and selling, whatever. So yeah. you can obtain an approval to work with them. So, and by the way, that's not
which
just...
Which Compass has, right?
Which Compass has, which all of ours, our entities have. So we obviously, right. This is really, really important. Again, like we're not like a cannabis company who tries to find a loophole. We are a very, in that sense, a very traditional classic biotech company, which has yeah. a number of drugs or compounds in development. Yeah, more than 10 in our case. And we do it like... very by the book, because that's, I think, is the important thing. So I'm on the one side, yeah, I'm very open to talk about my personal experience and sort of the let's call it, I don't know, spiritual, like, or the overlay and the fun stories like the stone ape theory. But at the same time, and I think that goes hand in hand, I think it's super important that we once and for all prove that in an, let's call it an undeniable, super scientific, very rigorous process, because we don't want to do the same mistake which had happened in the last century, where people were too loosely, too quickly, sort of, let's call it, promoting it. And then you get the backlash if you can't sort of prove it. Like, and by the way, that I wanted to say, so sorry to go back to when we get distracted by the stone ape theory, but because you asked, like, how did we come to these substances? Like, what I wanted to say is, like, we reinvented the business side in this millennia, but there were or are amazing people who actually, how you say, held the torch, like, or like,
yeah.
were like supporting or were like keeping the research going on the pure research side, even, let's say, through the last, what is it, like 30, 40 years when it was not cool. So, and I really, 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 really appreciate and think they should be always mentioned and applauded. Like, there is a Rick Doblin who's running MAPS, who's focusing on MDMA. But there is, for example, to come to Ibogaine, there is my colleague Deborah Mesh. Yeah, she is Mrs. Ibogaine since decades. Oh. And she was doing all the research with addiction when addiction was not on the forefront of every newspaper.
Where is she?
She's based in Miami.
Okay.
You should have her on. She's amazing. And what we did with the sort of classic psychedelics, yeah, we went to these people and were like, look, we think it's the time now to try it again, to bring them into the medical world. You have the knowledge about the substance. We have the capital, yeah, but we also have, which is very important, we have the knowledge about how to get things approved. So we have a very strong yeah. regulatory team in Atai, and you need all of that. You need the research, you need the sort of the regulatory strategy, trial design or whatever, and you need the capital. And we were like not trying to do it without those people, together with them. So, and this is how we onboarded them as partners and partnered with all these sort of legendary people for the core psychedelics. And we also then in Atai sort of are working on the next generation of psychedelics, like sort of trying to design new ones like famous Shulgin did in the 70s.
Get more of The Times and The Sunday Times for less than £1 a day. Visit thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley to start your free trial. That's once again, thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley so that they know I sent you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
I don't, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
And so what is the timeline? And I recognize that there's going to be a different timeline for each drug.
Exactly, yeah.
But in terms of, you know, it feels like getting the first across the line and out into the world in a therapeutic setting, for example, would be a very big deal because it would, again, kind of show the way. So what does that look like in terms of timing?
I would say it's years with an S, but not decades. So, and as you said, like we... it's different for every single one of our compounds. Compass, in our family, Compass with psilocybin is most advanced. They have a readout end of this year for their phase 2B trial. Then there follows a phase 3. But we're talking, and this is in biotech terms, it's pretty advanced and pretty short, talking about years, not decades.
Yeah. And phase 2B is, that's safety still before you get to efficacy.
No, it's also efficacy.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's both. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say in biotech terms, it's always the most decisive one because then you really can say we know and not just we assume.
Right. And not to get kind of too philosophical, but just when you talk about, you know, before you got into this world, you're like, oh my God, there's a billion people who have mental struggles. Do you have any thoughts on kind of where we are now? And, you know, I'm saying this coming from a place where I'm covering social media all the time. And the effects that that is having on people and this, you know, supercomputer that everybody is staring at all day long. How does that factor into what you guys are trying to do? Because obviously they're related.
So I have a theory, like it's my personal one, so it's not a scientific one. But like, for meaning, super simplified said, the world we live in is very bad for our brain. Yeah. And the world we're building, because we're just at the beginning. So, and I think it's always like, so one theory I have is we all believe, like you and I and all my friends, like your friends in Silicon Valley, like we all love what we're doing. Yeah. And I think it's an honest love. Like, so it's positive. But like, so we do forget. So when I go back at a class reunion or something, like, or when I talk to people who are not in the tech world, like how frightening the world can be to humans. So that it's just a small minority of people who really sort of are super comfortable with the world and especially the vision of the world we're going to build in the next 10, 20 years. And let's not kid ourselves, like the next 10, 20 years is going to be so incredibly disruptive and transformative for how we live. Meaning, if you want to be super philosophical, even how we are as humans, yeah, that it's completely alienating a vast majority of people. And sort of that fear, again, if what I said before, like what are drivers for mental health issues? It's trauma, it's fear, it's all these negativity. Yeah. So, and I think that fear is putting really the entire world on a mental health problem. One thing I was sort of finding, and unfortunately, and I hopefully we have the solution, but an analogy for like the last time that happened in history was like the time of 1850 following. So if you go back, and I'm a history geek, so I started reading a lot of books at the time. And by the way, there are famous authors like Jules Verne who wrote all these sci-fi books, yeah, and people going to the moon and
right.
Then undersea boats. Meaning, and by the way, if you go back into that time, if you try to find newspapers out of the time or books, that by the way, the Paris World Exhibition happened in that time, like 1860 something, I think, where they built the Eiffel Tower. You had an elite which was dreaming the future, and scarily, it was the same we do now. It was like, hey, we're gonna go to the moon, we're gonna have flying cars, meaning whatever. And it was actually a time similar like today, where a lot of what we would call now platform technologies were invented. It was actually the car, it was the phone, and it was electricity. So these were the platform technologies of that time, and around these
that were in the process or on the cusp of completely transforming how we live as humans.
Everything. Yeah, literally everything. So because we were at the cusp of the Industrial Revolution, but what these elite forgot is that the vast majority of people back then were farmers and living in rural countries, rural parts. And I think they were deeply terrified of that sort of vision of the future. And fear is like, I mean, there is this famous, I love Dune, the novel, and I mean, there is this poem against fear, yeah, because fear is always bringing out the worst in people. And if you look, what did people do, the ordinary people, they try to find a resort, or they try to retract into two very bad ideologies. Communism was invented, and nationalism. So it was practically ideas which were deadly wrong, literally deadly wrong. But for a time, for a certain time, they gave people the feeling of belonging. They gave people a false security. Like they gave people community. So, and if you look what's happening now, I have actually really some friends I know, they believe in QAnon. Yeah. And in the first instance, you're like, how can you be so stupid? Like,
people in your circle, which is obviously, you know.
No, like more like many broader, like, yeah, like, but yeah. Like sort of high school friends who text me with weird conspiracy theories and are like, oh, you must know that this is happening. And I was like, no, like, it's not.
Yeah,
but like, or the whole vaccine. Hey, there's so many things. I don't want to actually put one out now because then people might be alien. But what I want to say is like it's the same happening again. If you look at the time back then.
So what are the platform technologies when you talk about, you know, this is a bad time for our brains? Is it like the smartphone? Is that what you're talking about?
It's everything. It's like it's not. I mean, so I think we can go on different levels. We can say social media and the smartphone is already super bad for your brain. Yeah. Let's stop there. Like we can. My favorite example is like. There are great studies out there with rats and whatever where you can show that permanent comparison and external feedback and all of that is terribly for your brain. It's at first it was super addictive. So the likes on Instagram, but also seeing people who are seemingly always hotter than you are, better off than you are, bigger boobs than you have, like whatever, makes your brain, it's really bad. There's this one study where if you put two rats in two cages next to each other and they can see each other, and the one is an alpha rat, so a strong one, and the other one is a beta rat, but they cannot hurt each other because there is like the cage in between. The beta rat, just by looking at the alpha rat, but always have sort of a better version, almost to say, like, becomes depressive, and develops sign of depression. So social media is bad. But then, so practically, meaning there is the things we already have which are bad for our brain, which we do, like social media, and then there is sort of what I tried to describe before is like sort of these undefined fear of the future. Take a bus driver, yeah. So he or she might not be able to explain in detail what AI is, but somehow he or she knows that deep down, gut feeling, that in 10 years, the bus will be not driven by a human being. So they have fear of losing their existence, losing their purpose. Yeah. By the way, that's another way to put it. So if I talk with friends about mental health, I think what we need, or I think there is, by the way, and disclaimer, it's very Christian theory, like not proven scientifically. But I think I thought a lot, and there is already great studies out there about the idea of resilience. So why similar things happening to similar people, but they have different ways to cope with it. So for example, with death. Or anyway, so when bad things happen, some people seem to be resilient to it. Yeah, some people not. And my, again, super personal theory, not scientifically, I think it's like that we have kind of an immune system in our brain, and it consists actually of three things. It consists of faith, which is any form of belief, spirituality. Mm-hmm. And by the way, why? Because the biggest worry you have, and I'm very sure you wouldn't normally talk about it, is that either you die, but even worse, your children or your loved ones can die. Yeah, yes. And that is sort of a constant fear everybody of us has. I think everybody is afraid of personally accident to yourself and to the loved ones. And religion, I think the best religion does, and it's not a proof that God exists, but what any form of spirituality does, it's sort of mitigating a little bit that sort of fear we all have every single minute of our lives. And that's, I think, is a very, very healthy thing. This is why I think is one of the reasons why literally our brain needs faith and spirituality. So the second big thing our brain seems to need is purpose. We want to be needed. We want to have a job. We want to have a purpose in life. We want to know in the morning when we wake up sort of why we're here, what is our sort of place in society and our positive like role in it. And then the third one, which we seem to need, very cheesy now, I know, but is love. Like we need a community with other people, like close one. We also need a bigger one, like, I don't know, a sort of social field. So, and if you look at what was also happening in our world, partly because of technology, partly because of where sort of social developments are going, is that actually exactly those three things, faith, purpose, and love, are actually massively on the decline. So Faith is like evaporated. Purpose, what I already said, like I think a lot of people feel that the job they're doing now will not be around in 20 years anymore, and that terrorizes them. And then also love and communities are sort of dissolved. Yeah, and that I think is together sort of literally diminishing the sort of virtual immune system we have. And now if I go back to psychedelics, all of them one way or the other, that's actually what they give you back. You have some form of spirituality normally after it. Yeah, it can be wider, this can be like, but like they always, psychedelics give you these sort of spiritual, mystical experience. Yeah, they always show you what you really want in life, and actually positively, like they show you what everybody of us, like everybody has something to contribute in a positive meaning. Everybody has a value for him or herself. Yeah. And they give you back sort of the self-awareness, self-pride.
But that doesn't always happen though, does it? Sometimes people just have a really bad trip and it sends them in a completely different avenue. And I'm thinking of a couple of people from college who I know who mushrooms in particular sent them off in a path, and they're institutionalized. And I don't know if that was the mushrooms per se, but maybe it was just accentuated their issues, but it was kind of the quintessential bad trip from which they did not return.
What we can say, we have never found hard evidence so far, not in our studies, not in the massive anecdotal and sort of old studies back of in the last century, which supported what you said. So that I would call, in the way you said it, I would call it an urban legend. Yeah. So that people don't return. Yeah, we haven't found anything like that ever. And there have been so many studies in the last century.
But everybody knows somebody who's had a bad trip.
Yeah, so everybody knows somebody is the typical saying for an urban legend. But no, but I know what you want.
I know somebody personally.
Okay, no. But like definitely not come back. So like, what people do have, what is colloquially described as a bad trip. Yeah, mm-hmm. That can happen. Yeah. So I had actually two trips which you would colloquially describe as a bad trip. However, and that's important, is I don't like the word because like they can be equally strong healing trips.
Yeah.
So I like to call them challenging trips. Yeah. Because sometimes the experience you have to make to learn something or dissolve a trauma or whatever can be very, very unpleasant, but it's giving you healing. And this shows the importance, why actually these were the most impressive things I've seen with oppressive, like friends who went through a, it's called a bad trip or challenging trip, and then were healed of severest trauma. But they even more need a guide, a therapist with them.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of the reason. Yeah. So this is why also why I'm so adamant that, and I know, yeah, to pre-take the question, because I know a lot of people are saying, oh, he's saying that because he wants to make a business out of it and it's a better business, yeah, if you keep it medically. And it's really bullshit, yeah, because if you have seen people who really need it for healing, yeah, they need a therapist. This can be, as you say, a very challenging trip, yeah, which has to be guided by a pro. But then, especially those challenging trips can sort of help.
The other thing, just thinking about kind of again, you know, how a lot of this has to be, or all of these kind of treatments have to be kind of guided by a pro. How big a challenge is it finding those pros? Because right now, again, this is kind of it's certainly not mainstream. You don't have every psychiatrist under the sun be like, yeah, I know how to like conduct psilocybin-based therapy.
No, so we have, and we're developing that, so we have to train the therapists. But the good thing is it's not a novel training. It's like, it's sort of, call it an add-on to their profession. I actually think it will, and I know it because I spoke to a lot of psychotherapists, and a lot of them are actually frustrated because they know there had been these solutions in the last century. Actually, some of them still do it underground, because if you are a psychotherapist or a doctor, you swore an oath to help your people, your patients. Yeah. And if you were around in the 60s and it was medically available and you saw that this is helping, and then for no reason than political one, the government took it away from you, and you see patients suffering, yeah, some of them still sort of found a workaround, let's call it that way. And I think most of them are eagerly awaiting that they finally get tools which really have the potential to help their patients, really, and not just like the best case at the moment a psychotherapist can achieve, super simplifying said now, is sort of keeping the patient stable. Yeah.
Right.
But like most people are then on SSRIs forever. That's all not a cure. It's like sort of an ongoing treatment. Yeah. Most people need psychotherapy forever. Yeah. To just keep them stable. Yeah. And I think we hope that we give those psychotherapists like the real curative solutions at hand.
With Mike Novogratz and Peter Thiel and yourselves, I mean, it sounds like you guys basically created and funded this company to get to where it is. Is that fair?
Well, over time, like we did a Series C round last year and we did a Series D earlier this year. And in these two rounds, then actually also already institutions came on board. So it really changed. I mean, as I said before, like the perception changed in kind of mid-2020. Yeah.
Do you know why? Was it
I said it was like, I think sometimes things happen, and meaning a lot of, I would say, what's it called, synchronicity, like things happen at the same time. Like, again, I think it was both the awareness of the problem, so that when you look at the opioid crisis, this really became sort of the problem is there since a while, but like it became obvious to the public that there is a problem, also like 2020. So in general, I think mental health as maybe the biggest problem of our time in healthcare sort of surfaced onto the radar of people in 2020. Then actually our research, meaning not just the research the companies are doing, but like also the Compass is supporting a lot of university research. Like, so there are a lot of other, like, meaning there was a lot of great basic research, like from Robin Carateris, from Imperial College and so on. Like, then you had, as I said, the book of Michael Pollan. Like, there were many, many, many bits and pieces.
Right.
Yeah. And we are one of them, which sort of led to these psychedelic renaissance.
I want to shift gears for a second, because you do lots of interesting stuff, and talk about events. Because you are a DEAG.
Yes. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a big live events, live music company.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's one of the biggest ones, independent ones in Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. What does life look like right now? And what's the last year been?
So the funny thing for DAG, which stands for Deutsche Entertainment, was that we were insured. We were one of the very few life insurance companies which were insured specifically against the pandemic, because you had to take...
How were you insured against a pandemic?
Again, like sometimes, I mean, you can always, I could say like, because we're super smart or the management is super smart. The management is super, but the management had an insurance disaster like years ago where they were not fully insured against, in that case, it was back then, I think it was like a natural disaster. So they were especially sort of careful and thinking about the whole insurance side, which, by the way, supports my spiritual view that any bad thing which happens to you in life, you can turn it into something even better. You just need to trust the universe that this is a sign. This is how I handle every bad event. Yeah. And people are always saying, oh, you're always happy. Like, but like I do have bad days, bad events. Yeah. But I'm very, and I deeply, deeply believe that everything bad which happens must be something good. I just don't see it yet. Yeah. And so I call it always the J curve effect of things, like in venture, like things go down first, but then they can go really up. Like, and the same, like, so DAG, because something bad had happened, when was it, like 2015? Yeah. They were like fully insured to a good extent. And then in Germany, I have to say, big shout out to the German government. They handled, and then the biggest market is Germany. So the German government was very supportive to the entire creative industry, to events, to filmmakers, whatever. So, and practically insurance plus government support was actually okay. Meaning it's sad if you can't work practically. Yeah. But so the company as a company absurdly was doing fine. Yeah. But now we're eagerly awaiting the first concert.
Do you think the pandemic will fundamentally change the industry? Because I'm just thinking personally, like, and I'm in California. Last week, the kind of state reopened. We're 40 million people. And theoretically, if you're vaccinated, you can go out. You don't have to wear a mask, all of this stuff. And people are still trying to figure out what that means. Like, half the people have a mask. Some people are still staying at home. Nobody really knows what to do, but I don't know anybody who's like, yeah, I can't wait to go to a concert where this talking disease can be spread.
That's a good question. Meaning, I personally think humans in our deepest nature don't change. And we are social animals. We want that. And there is maybe, meaning, oh, by the way, and young people, I think differently. Like, yeah, look at Miami. Yeah. Seriously, I was like the first 6 weeks while the pandemic was not over officially, I was in Miami and I was like in Disneyland, like, and I was like, wow, like, even for me, and I'm like, I was not so anxious, but like, I was like, okay, that's daring. Yeah. So I think we need that. So, and maybe there is a, how you say, a transition period of some weeks, some months, but like, and you see that actually in concerts which are put on for next year, they're sold out actually quicker than they ever have been. Yeah, I think people have a hunger for life.
Right. I hope you're right, and I hope it all works out.
Yeah, but again, we are humans, and we're not going to change.
No.
Again, I think we need more after the pandemic. I think, by the way, and sadly, to make again the link to mental health, like, the pandemic is one of the big drivers. So mental health was a problem before, and now it's a bigger problem. Like, we are not meant to be solitary people. Like, we are community. And by the way, one of my things, which, sorry that I'm sort of bringing up the point without you asking, but I think it's a really important one because, and it fits in sort of this concept question. Like, what I do believe and what I'm trying to work on politically is that, just if you look at the sort of, let's call it, acknowledged mental health issues like depression, anxiety, addiction, whatsoever, this, you come to these more than 1 billion people. But I actually think we have already today more mental health issues in our society, which we have not given a name to. And as long as we don't name them fully, we cannot cure them. It's a little bit, it reminds me like post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
Yeah.
Wasn't known, but people had it. Like, so after the World War, people were acting most likely equally odd than people after the Iraq War. But like, back then, people were like, okay, you know what, be happy you survived the war, go man up, whatever. And just like late in the 2000s, we ask ourselves, maybe there is something wrong or something we can treat. And then PTSD was termed. And since then, we really found. Yeah. And are, so anyway, so... And for example, my near-term thing is like loneliness, meaning at least we have already a name for it, yeah? But loneliness, from my point of view, is a treatable disease. So we don't need to be lonely. So, but people are lonely. Look at an old people's home. Yeah. You could say, like, why are these people lonely? Why are they sitting in the last years of their life when they could enjoy it? I always say, like, an old people's home could be like a summer camp. Like back to what we were when we were 10, 12, like you are together with your friends, you have time, you can enjoy life, you can talk about everything, whatever. But why don't they do it? Why do people sit in their rooms and stare out of the window? I think because our brain, in older we get, we're not able to make new friends, or the ability to make new friends is going down. Yeah. So right. we're not as open for life as we used to have been. Yeah. Now comes a psychedelic trip. I think a psychedelic trip has the potential to change that. I think a psychedelic trip can literally, or does actually, we already see that, like make you open for the world again, and especially open for other people. So I could see a future where we define loneliness as an illness. And once we, and the UK actually made a big step forward and did so and named it as a problem illness. Yeah, and then I deeply hope that someone, we will be able to run trials, like really clinical trials, to prove that psychedelics could help people connect better, especially in a higher age. Yeah, and that would completely change the way people are aging and people are spending their last years, which I really, really wish for, because they deserve like a happy ending.
Yeah. Lastly, just very quickly, you mentioned, how you say it?
Apeiron.
Where did your money initially come from? Is this family money, or did you just start?
It's self-made. I started a biotech company with two of my professors when I was 20, so a long time ago. And so that was the first wealth creation. And since then, I'm sort of, as I said, I'm doing both. I'm investing, and we're in the meantime one of the larger venture investors, I think, globally. But also once in a while, like a Thai, starting companies myself.
And producing films.
And producing movies, which I think is important, because I think you have to be creative in life. And I want to be sort of live out my creative passion.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I have a movie about happiness. Like, to promote.
You do?
It.
Oh, yeah. So it's called Happiness, right?
It's called Hector and the Search for Happiness with Rosamund Pike and Christopher Plummer. Yeah. So it was actually before my mushroom experience, or around the time. Explored side of the concepts of happiness and why our society is not really happy.
Well, I look forward to having you on the pod again. Hopefully it won't take another 2 years, but it's fascinating.
Anytime. Like, so many stuff to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Christian for taking the time again. Another repeat offender for Danny in the Valley, which I always enjoy catching up with people who have been on the pod. I want to thank you guys for listening. I am off this week, so nothing in the paper from me, but there's tons of stuff I've written on the website. You know, go there, check it out, have a search around thetimes.co.uk. You can also find me on Twitter, although I won't be tweeting much, I don't think, unless they're beach pictures or something, at Danny Fortson on Twitter. And that's it. I will be back next week with another pod. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Have a fabulous weekend. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Want more out of this podcast? Go to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley to read articles based on these interviews, broader discussions of the topics covered here, and of course, the amazing work of all my colleagues across the rest of the paper, all for less than £1 a day. Start your free trial now by going to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.